My name is Robert, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March 7th, 1995, so that means, so you don't have to do the math, I've got 9 years and some change. And my record before I got to AA was 4 days. So if you're new, this works. I'll say this, a couple of things that come to mind is, one, there's no way in the next hour that I'm going to be able to tell you how to work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and most of you don't need me to. As I understand it, my job up here is to get up and just be an example of AA and that it works. And to tell you the truth, I'll do that much more the 23 hours of the day that I'm not in a meeting as opposed to the one or one and a half that I am. So I'm sure I'll forget to say something. I'm sure I'll forget an important part of the program or an important part of my story. But as I looked up the word intimate recently, it says a sharing of one's innermost self. And though I might not share the details, hopefully I'll share with you my heart and that AA is a success, and that all the successes that I have are a direct relationship of this program and people like you in this room. So for that, I'm very, very grateful. I wrote the names down because, of course, when I stand up here, I get a little nervous. Matt and Bob. Matt, welcome. Bob, congratulations on 60 days. There are a lot of people in this room that have a lot of time, but my feeling is that 30 days, 60 days, 90 days is a long time without a drink. A very long time. I mean, I remember celebrating 17 days deliriously. I remember thinking 100 days was just out of the question. And I could not believe that anybody who had 10 years or 20 years really not only drank the way I drank, but thought the way I thought. You might have drank as much as I did, but you didn't sit on the bar stool and think the things that I thought. And the only way that I found out that you did is I got to become friends with you, and I got to very quietly share with you what was going on with me, and most of the time you'd laugh and just kind of shake your head and say, you know, you're not alone, and you're not that different, Robert, and welcome, and, you know, this too shall pass, and, you know, all those other things that at first just bugged the living crap out of me, but that I came to love. And to tell you the truth, I didn't come here because I thought you were going to love me and help me. I came here because I had no other place to go. That's the truth. I had no other place to go. And if you're new, no offense, I hope you have no other place to go. I hope your life is falling apart. I hope you're in severe pain. I hope the IRS finds you in a couple of days. You know, I hope those, you know, failure to appear is kind of, you know, that you appear and things like that, because I'll tell you, I'll get to what it was, I'll go through the normal format in a minute, but the thing is, I'll tell you that for me, when I stopped running, the world caught up. You know, so like all of a sudden, you know, I got a checking account. Well, then the IRS could find me, and which they've been looking. And, you know, other people could find me. The courts could find me. People could find me. And the good thing is that that which I could not do for myself was brought to me. And you guys gave me the tools, and God gave me the strength to deal with my life because I did not know how. So a little bit about what it was like. I'll try to spend equal portions on it because I think all of the story for an alcoholic is important. The first part so that you can identify maybe and hear the similarities as opposed to the differences. The next part so that I can remember what happened and what, you know, I can remember what it was like. I can remember what happened, and then I can tell you the really cool part about what it's like today. Right, because if I just started with what it's like today, you'd just think I was a freak and you probably wouldn't identify with me, because I'm really, really lucky, you know, and I have no other word for that besides grace and God's ability and grace to forgive me, because if I got what I deserved, I wouldn't be dead. I would be dying the slow and painful death that I was dying. Right? I don't pray for what I deserve. I don't pray for patience. That's insane. If I got what I deserved, I wouldn't be dead. I would be dying slowly in a gutter, miserable. So now for a happy note. So I was born, and that was good for me. You know, I was born into a family of alcoholism, right? My father used to put beer in my bottle. And my mom's attracted to men who do those types of things. So you know, it was a party. And so even when he left, she just replaced him with somebody really like him. And so, you know, I felt alone and scared and different before I ever took a drink, right? And I'm sure that I was, if anybody had asked the right questions, I would have been classified insane or something else. And I tried everything I could to deal with it, right? And there were things that, there were certain things in my life that really made me feel different. My name is Robert Hudoc, not a very common name, not even in my family. My mom, I'm not my mother's only child, and I'm not from my mother's only marriage, and I'm the only Hudoc that I know to this day. I've only met my father a couple of times. He decided at 4 that I'd kicked him off and that he didn't ever want to see me again. You know, I met him, and that was the best thing that ever happened to me, or one of. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way, is I needed to find another way to deal with life than the way that he did. That's all. Good man, bad man, I don't know. But I know that I'm probably better off not having him as an influence, and that's all. So the way that my life worked out is that I had an older brother named Jimmy who took care of me. I grew up in a rather violent household. Though my mom wasn't an alcoholic, she had a little bit of a temper. and so my household was just scary at times. And if you can understand, I don't need to tell you the details. I can just tell you, if you were scared in your house, I was scared in mine. Okay? And I had a big brother, Jimmy, who was probably very scared too, and was even scared that things would happen to me. And so he did his best to protect me. So Jimmy, my mom didn't have to get a babysitter for me. My brother Jimmy took care of me. My brother Jimmy was about 9 years older than me, so when he would even sometimes take me on dates. It was like he was a single parent. And I had another brother and a sister, and basically they did their best. If something got broken, like if I broke something or did something wrong, I can tell you this. I can tell you about the bad things that happened in my family, but I can also tell you that I was never, ever struck in anger by any of my siblings. They never did anything mean to me. And I think it was a direct proportion because they witnessed what it's like, and they loved me with everything they had. And so I was really raised by 3 kids. My two brothers and my sister. And I love my brother Jimmy probably the most just because I knew him the best. And when I was 9 years old, he died. The way that I interpreted that is that if I had been more fun, he wouldn't have gone away that weekend. And so at a pretty early age of 9, I started taking on some pretty big responsibilities. And probably by the time I was 13, though I was the youngest in the family, I had taken on the role of the oldest. By 13, I was working. My brother and sister at that time, my sister was already had one kid and was was working on her second. And she wasn't working, and my brother Donnie was out of the military, and he wasn't working, so I was working. And I was giving my money to my mom so that we could make ends meet. And so my mom stopped calling. My name's Robert, but my mom calls me Bobby. But at that time, she would slip and call me Jimmy a lot. I guess because I'd just taken on that role. And my mom did the best she could. If my mom was up here telling her story, it was a much harder story than I've had. Much harder. And I love my mom very much today as a result of this program. And I cry because I remember the pain and I remember the scar, but I also know the joy that I feel now when I think about these things. That I remember my brother Jimmy, and I'm so grateful that God gave him to me. And I think of my mom, and I'm so grateful that God gave her to me. And what we had to go through to get what I had to go through to get here is just what I had to go through. So Jimmy died, and I thought if I'd been more fun, if I'd been a better kid, he wouldn't have gone off with his friends that weekend, and he wouldn't have drowned. At that point in time, I became a straight-A student. I'm like all of about, you know, 9, 10 years old. I become a straight-A student. I'm a straight-A student for like the next 6 years. Don't get a B. I joined the wrestling team, the football team, the track team. As a little guy, I was like undefeated in wrestling. And this is all little sports. You know, I'm like, I set the state record for touchdowns, right? I'm winning first-place ribbons in the Junior Olympics in sprinting. And I'm doing everything I can to be loved. You know, I'm doing everything I can so that people don't leave.
Okay.
And when that stopped working, I went the other way. I stopped playing sports in high school. I found alcohol. I stopped doing well in school. I'd already proved them. I'd been put in the gifted program. They told me I was a genius. I had a little paper that said it, so I didn't have anything else to prove. You know, who needs an A? I'm a genius, right? And I'd point that out to my teachers, which went really well. I was raised by kids, you know, to be honest. I was raised by kids. And though they loved me all they could, it's like, you know, the four of us were doing the best we could. And when my brother left, the three of us were doing the best we could. And you know what? I wouldn't change a bit of it. I really wouldn't. I wouldn't change a bit of it. So what happens? You know, I can tell you a little bit more. I went to, I think, 14 schools in 12 years. And no, I don't come from a military family, just an alcoholic one. You say this stuff to people outside and they go, oh, wow, you know, not that I mention it that often, but, you know, they're like, where are you from? And I'm like, that's a story in itself, you know? You know, and I can tell you I was born in Savannah, Georgia, and then, you know, my mom meets this guy while she's working at the prison, and he's an inmate, not a worker, and so he decides that we should move to Arizona, and then we get there, and he decides that, well, who knows what he decided, not to come back, and, you know, next thing I know, we're in New Orleans, and next thing I know, at the age of 17, my mom says, you know, basically, I just can't do this anymore, and she had every right to say that. I'd become an animal because I'd started drinking 4 years prior to that. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff that happened in my life, but I'll tell you this, that no matter what happened in my life, AA has been the solution for me. You know, all this stuff AA has solved for me, so to speak. And what it means is I don't regret the past because I can probably help you if you've had any type of similar experiences, then I can identify with you. That's why if I got up here and just told you, oh, yeah, this is great, you know, and I'm wonderful, and I pray, and I, you know, and my life just goes well, and when it doesn't go well, I just kind of realize I probably have a bad perspective. I mean, if I heard somebody say that, I'd be like, freak, you know, I'm like, where do you come from, you know, and so that's why I really think I have to share the whole thing, is that all these things that happened in my life led me here. So at 13, I'm feeling, you know, I'm still that straight-A student, undefeated wrestler, blah, 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 you know, and really all that is fear. All that is fear. And I grew up in areas where I was the minority. And I grew up in areas where I studied martial arts at a young age and learned how to wrestle at a young age because I was scared. And I would attack big guys for one very good reason, is that if you lose to a big guy, it's not that big a deal. And most people won't mess with you because they think if you're crazy enough to do that, they pretty much leave you alone. And with 14 schools in 12 years, I got really good at just attacking somebody really fast. Not because I'm big and bad and know a lot of stuff, except for that I know how to protect myself in survival situations, right? And so I learned that just because that was the situation I was put into. So really all the things that I did were mainly out of fear and insecurity and really just confusion and loneliness. So 13, I'm in this junior fraternity, if you will, that's kind of grooming me to be a young politician and, you know, things like that. I don't need to get into the group, but it was a very good group and tried to teach me morals, but also it was for a young man aged 13 to 21 in New Orleans, where the drinking age is 18. And the group that sponsors us is a very, very powerful, influential group of men in New Orleans, and they own a lot of bars. So I go to a party, and this is the first time I drank that I chose to drink. There were a few other times in my life that I just, you know, booze was given to me, I'm 9 years old, you know, whatever, but at 13 I chose to drink. I chose to drink, and I went to this party, and there were really cute girls, and there were big guys that were intimidating, and there was music to dance to, and they had alcohol. Oh, thank God they had alcohol. I wouldn't have known what to do. And I didn't see me the way you saw me. I only saw me the way I saw me. So I needed to be different. And so I took a drink, and I went up and I talked to the two girls. And I picked a fight with one of the guys. And I was having fun. And I felt like I belonged. I felt bulletproof. Right? It was perfect. I was like, and I drank, and I even picked a fight with my good friend Steve, who gave me a ride and just realized I was a little shit and didn't care. And I mean, it was just this huge fiasco, and he takes me, you know, we go back to his house, I fall asleep, I wake up the next day, no hangover, just bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, like 7 a.m. going, let's go again. Like, when's the next party? Right? When do we get to do this again? I want that feeling again. And so every chance I got, I'll tell you, by 14, I was sitting in a bar drinking Jägermeister and Kamikaze. I'm not a beer and wine kind of guy. My story is that I didn't really find other, I have friends who say, alcohol in other forms, right? I didn't really need that because I had alcohol. I had full access to it. I'm a good old-fashioned Southern drunk. Right? If you did drugs, I did them too, right? So did Bill. He took high-powered sedatives with alcohol. It's mentioned right in his story. But I will tell you that nothing did for me what alcohol did for me. It is my drug of choice by far. I loved it. In the movie, if you've seen Leaving Las Vegas, right, where Nicolas Cage is in the liquor store and he's like dancing around and he's like looking at his friends, alcohol, that's what I'm thinking, right? He's like, I miss Jack, right? And he's like buying Jack and he's dancing with the booze. That's how I am, right? That's not how it goes for very long, but that's how I was. So alcohol is my drug of choice. If it's not yours, cool. You know, that's fine. I've done 12-step work with heroin addicts to, you know, to sippers of wine. And the things that I found that I have in common with them is the feelings. You know, the feelings, the fears, the insecurities, the doubts. So it was absolutely beautiful. So I'm drinking as much as I can. And by the time I'm 17, I'm no longer that straight-A student, no longer that athletic not standing out in sports or anything like that, and just kind of getting by in school and wrecking cars and telling lies to my mom and not showing up to school and all these things. And finally, for my 17th birthday, my mom said, you got a one-way ticket anywhere but here. And I had I could have either moved out on my own. And I don't come from a wealthy family, so it wasn't like, here's some money and go someplace. It was, here's a ticket. Here's a plane ticket. And here's some luggage to put your stuff in. When you get there, you're going to have to fend for yourself. So luckily, God gave me my aunt and uncle. And I moved to California at 17 and finished out high school there. And I, you know what, got my first DUI at 20. I'd have looked you square in the eye at 19 and said, I'm an alcoholic. Right? I'm an alcoholic. Watch the way I drink. It's pretty obvious. Right? It's not real hard. And I really believe that the way that this worked was that I was given all these gifts. You know, here I am, I'm supposedly gifted and really smart and all this other stuff, and I'm given all these challenges, like I can't just seem to hold it together and I drink like a fish, right? And my family, so I'm given these really good things, I'm given these tough things, and I thought my job was to build up these good things so much to overcome the bad, right? That I can't be given all these good things without these bad things, and this is just the way it works, and so my job is to, you know, I can't really do anything about my alcoholism, so I need to make enough money so that I don't get in trouble, right? So that I can pay for DUIs on a credit card. Right? California let me do that. I am really grateful. Get a DUI, take a visa, right? And it was great. And you know what? I just remembered something that's really, really important. I don't know if I believed in God as a small child, but I know the day my brother died, I drew a line and told him to stay the hell out of my life. And that's important because at age 9, I was like, okay, God, if you're there, because I'd see my mom in the middle of the living room crying, wondering why we didn't have enough to eat and why this was going on and why this man left or why this happened, and going, please God help me. And I never saw him help my mom. I couldn't see it at that time. And then when my brother died, I said, that's it. That's it. God, I don't know if you exist, but if so, you don't like me and I don't like you. And if you please stay out of my house, I won't go to church. It was that simple. I'll stay out of your house, stay out of mine. And if you send Christians to me, we're going to have a problem. And so that's the way I felt. That's the way I felt. I was like, if there is a God, he doesn't like me. Right? And I can tell you lots of reasons that I thought that. My mom, being a divorced woman in the South, was asked to not go to a few churches, things like that. But that those are people, right, that did that. That's not God. Right? Those are people that acted like that. And so I didn't see God. I did not see God working in my life. In fact, I did see God working in my life. I saw him take my dad. I saw him take my brother. I saw him take men that I got attached to that my mom dated. I saw him I saw that my life, that the people that I loved the most either left or were in misery. And so when I drew that line, I meant it. I'm like, I will not step foot in a church. Please stay out of my life. And the reason that's important is because I don't know if you've noticed, if you're new, but, you know, God's mention of a power greater than yourself. When I say God, I just mean a power greater than yourself. However you define that, cool. Right? Whatever works for you, the big book really good, has some really good advice that helped me define a power greater than myself. So I just had to share that with you because, of course, if you've been in this program for, you know, a little while, you understand that God, you know, me building a relationship with a power greater than myself is really important, has been really important for me. And so here I am at 9 years old deciding, God, get the hell out of my life. Right? When you show up, things don't go well. And that's the way I saw it. That was my perception. So, you know, I'm getting through life drinking like a fish and living in Southern California. And I get my first DUI at the age of 20. I mean, I'm blacking out. I'm at 19, 20, 21 years of age, I'm calling my friends and going, okay, I don't really remember the last part of last night. Just tell me this. Am I allowed back there or not? We don't really need to get into details. Not important. And you probably don't, you know, I'm not assuming that this person, you know, my friend, his name was Rob, also, and so I'd call up Rob and go, hey, am I allowed back there? You know, and that's what I considered a friend. A friend was the person I could call the next day who still liked me, even though, no matter what I had done, right? So I didn't have many of those, but I had one or two, and they drank the way I drank, and I'd always just go and say, am I allowed back there? You know, I think I had a really good time, and I'd like to go back, and I just want to know, can I go back? And he'd tell me yes or no, or, you know, he'd just kind of go, oh, my God, Robert. Actually, he'd call me Hoodoc. He goes, Hoodoc, dear Lord, why? And I would answer, I don't know, right, because that was the best answer. That was probably the most honest answer I could give. I had no idea why. Why I'd done those things, why, once again, I drank that much. So I, you know, I'm getting DUIs, and I'll tell you this. I had three DUIs, two drivings on a suspended, pulled over by cops numerous times and still let go. Even my last time they pulled me over, I already had three DUIs and drivings on a suspended. They pulled me over and I'm drunk as a skunk. And I just said, look, I'm trying to get sober. I made up a lie. Trying to get sober, you know, having problems with my girlfriend, didn't have a girlfriend. And I said, you know, I was sober up until today, and, you know, we had a bad fight, and I drank over it. And they're like, oh, that's pretty understandable, and, you know. And, you know, they don't know. They're taking me on my word, which is not wise, and, at that time. And, you know, I would have gone to jail for a couple of years. But I wasn't ready to get sober, so I was not going to go to AA. I went to AA a couple of times. I'll tell you, my first AA meeting. 21 years old, it's in like Moreno Valley, California, out by March Air Force Base, right? And so it's a little smoky room, and of course I show up a little late, and I'm sitting next to this guy, and I'm like, hey, you know, I need those court cards, right? You know, a little bit of a problem. And he says, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. Give me that damn thing. And he signed it, and I was like, good to know. John P. or whatever. I'm like, this is not so hard. I can do this. I can look, you know, it's like when somebody says go to six AA meetings or something like that, and I hear something like that, I'm like, I can forge six meetings, right? So I bought a book, a blue pen, a black pen, and a pencil. I'm a thoughtful criminal. In the sense, I'm like, well, let's not be stupid about this. I'm not going to be signing Robert H., right? You know, and so I get friends to sign them. I'm like, hey, you know, I've got this. I'm supposed to sign this. They'd all go, oh, yeah, ha, ha, ha. And you know, I get somebody to sign it. But I had the book to make sure that we were signing for real meetings, right? I mean, if you're going to forge, know what the heck you're doing. So if you're new and you go back out and you got to forge these things, you know, use a little common sense here. You know, being a good criminal helped. Right? Because it got me here faster, I think. So it did, because I didn't always suffer the consequences that way. I suffered them in other ways. The fact that I hated myself, that I didn't trust myself, the fact that no matter what I did every morning, I knew I was a lying sack of crap. Right? I never did what I was. I was always taking the harder road. Always. Right? Always. You know, I'll tell you this, a little bit more about my drinking. For $20, you can find everything you need to miss work. Maybe $40 now because prices have changed. But with a neck brace and an arm thing and a cane, you can look like a car accident. And if you need to fake liver surgery, I can talk to you about that, too, after the meeting. These are the things I did. I would be drinking, and it would be 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'm like, oh, I got to get to work tomorrow, and this isn't really going to work. And so I would, you know, and then I wouldn't wake up in time, and I'd be like, it'd be noon. And you can't call it noon and just say I slept in. Oops. Well, they would have believed me, but I couldn't do that. So I'd go, oh, isn't a really bad car accident, and I'll call you back tomorrow. Right, which gave me another day to drink, so I didn't make it the next day either. And so by the time I get in there 3, 4, 5 days later, I can't just bounce in and go, oh, yeah, that was really bad, I'm better now, let's get to work. So I'd come in, you know, with the arm brace and the neck brace and the cane and kind of go, I'm a trooper, right? I'm still coming to work, right? And it's like, I get out, and then it's like I'm thinking, well, what if somebody from work drives by me like this? So I got to drive around with a neck brace till I get home and then rip it off really fast because I'm leading this double life, right, or triple life or quadruple life, right? And because of the way I grew up, I don't like going to yuppie bars, right? And I'm doing well in a business world because I got into sales, and lying, cheating, and thieving isn't the only way to succeed in sales, but it's a way. It's not a way that worked for me after I got sober, but it was a way to make money. I don't think it was a way to be successful, but it was a way to make money. And so I went and hung out with bikers. That's where I'm from, right? Bikers and criminals, right? My mom worked at a prison. I hung out with the prisoners, right? We lived on whatever the wrong side of the tracks were on. I know where they were because that's where I lived. I can just give you addresses in many cities, and you can trust me. Don't go there, right? Parts of New Orleans, parts of Arizona, parts of Georgia. These are places you don't want to drive, right? These are not friendly, nice places. And so I'm very comfortable there, though. I know how to survive there. I know how to breathe there. I know how I'm judged there. So I would lead all these different lives, right? I'd try to show up to work and be like this nice young guy, you know, well-spoken, blah, blah, blah. And I didn't go to college because that actually required showing up, but I just like I did with AA, but I forged some really good diplomas. It's not that hard. So all that, right, needless to say, is when I say I'm a lie, cheat, and a thief, I mean it. You know, I'll tell you, the extreme. Here I am, literally wearing a double-breasted suit. You know, it's the 80s. I'm a somewhat successful salesperson. And at night, for kicks, I'm hanging out with bikers, doing drugs in public because nobody will mess with these guys, right? And then for kicks, you know, let's commit a little armed robbery, right? This, I can talk about it now at the podium because it's been over 7 years. If you're new, do keep this to yourself and your sponsor. That's what was told to me. I told my sponsor, I'm like, oh, my God. He's like, shut up. You've told me. We'll talk about how to make an amends. And the big book talks about that as well. So I tell you the only reason I say this is because it's been well over 7 years. And but it's just so that you can get to know me. And so honestly, you can see the miracle of what there is today, of what the way I live today. So my life is just insane. I mean, it's like it's utterly insane. I mean, it's like DUIs. I make over 6 figures a year, and I don't have a checking account. Right? So I have to go and cash my check with my passport because I can't get a license. Doesn't mean I didn't drive every day. If you get in the car with me, you'll see something kind of inconsistent about my personality. I drive really slow and kind of nice and let everybody in. 5 years without a license will do that. Good training. When they pulled me over, they kept me. Right? The police liked me a lot. They wanted to take me home. And so it's like any infraction, there was usually outstanding warrants and things like that, so I learned to drive really nice and politely, right? And, it's, you know, hey, that's a positive now. So, the reason I learned how to do that was because I never had a license. I didn't have insurance, I didn't have any of those things for many, many years. So this is the life I'm leading, you know? If you ask anybody at my work, they go, well, yeah, that Robert's a little crazy or something like that, but nobody had any idea about the double and triple life that I led, right? And so fast forward, I tried AA, right? I tried AA in Southern California. What I mean by tried is I showed up and I did the steps and I got 90 days. And after 90 days, I was like, this is exhausting. I can't do it. So I'm back. And in that 90 days, I had cleaned up things so much that I had actually been offered a job as a vice president of sales in Seattle, Washington. That's really good news. And I'm thinking, this is going to solve my problems. Because my problem is that I just don't have enough money. Right? I need to be able to pay for a limo every day. I need to be able to have lawyers on retainer. I need to be able to have somebody who is a bodyguard. You know, it's like just money will solve all this. And I didn't. But so in that 90 days, I get an offer as a VP of sales, and you know, it takes a few months to put that together. But basically what happens is I drink again for 11 and a half months. And I move from Southern California up to Seattle, Washington, and I'm a vice president. Don't be too impressed by that. There were four people in the company. I think I was a vice president of one, and they were smart enough not to even put me in charge of myself. So the CEO was in charge of me. And so, but it was, you know, that was it. This was it. We were going to put this together. We were starting this company. It was a company that we all knew how to run, or, you know, we'd worked for companies we'd done before. It was all going to be great and wonderful and marvelous. And I get to Seattle, and I just can't stop drinking. And I can tell you some other things happened, basically. But I really do believe at that point in time, I had gone to AA. I'd asked for God's help. I'd done a third step, and I chose to drink because I couldn't keep doing it. So I think God got really active in my life for the next 11 and a half months. Worst 11 and a half months of my life. Tricks didn't work anymore. Nothing. Alcohol didn't work. And what I mean by alcohol didn't work, it would put me to sleep, but it wouldn't make me feel any different. It wouldn't shut off my mind, and as soon as I woke up, that head was going again. Boom, 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 boom. I think Bob Earl talks about it as the vulture on the headboard. And wake, one little eye comes up and he goes, good morning. Been waiting for you. You're a worthless piece of shit. What are you going to get out of bed for? Right? Probably have cancer. Go back to bed. You're dead. Good thing I set my alarm. You know, and 11 and a half months. I will tell you, I learned some really good things from AA. You guys drank in the morning. How brilliant is that? I hate mornings. I wasn't drinking in mornings. I was driving to work, dry heaving because of nerves and hungover and cigarettes and everything else that I'd put into my system the night before. And I'm driving to work and I'm pulling over going, ugh, and I'm thinking, and you guys, people would talk and share their stories. That's why I'm sharing all the good things that I did. Because it was really good advice for me. I'm like, you know, my problem is I did not drink enough. I drink well over a fifth a day. I've woken up in other countries, and I think, my mind goes, you're not drinking enough. You've got to really step up your game here, Hudak, right? You've got to get serious about drinking. If you're unhappy and drinking makes you happy, drink constantly. Oh, why wait till noon? You know, that's for the pansies, right? Those are the weekend warriors who start drinking at noon. I'm going to get serious. So bottles just like this. Looks like water is today. yeah, I know. But I would fill these up with peppermint schnapps. Breakfast of champions. Breakfast of alcoholic champions. And so I would literally be driving to work. I learned this, honestly, I came to AA for 90 days, learned that I should be drinking a little bit harder. That was my problem. And that, so I'd fill up bottles of peppermint schnapps, and I started to keep a bottle in my office and a bottle in my car of various things. Peppermint schnapps is just a good breath freshener for the morning, if you will. And that's what I would drink on the way to work, and that would help me get to work, right? So the funny thing is that last 11 and a half months, I mean, everything falls apart, right? I'm drinking more and more and more, and you know, I get to experience that after 90 days that my drinking actually got, like, exponentially worse. I quit for 90 days, and I become twice as bad. I mean, that's nuts. And so if you go back out, good luck. there's nothing else to say there. So I wind up in Seattle, and you know what? The last day I drank, March 6, 1995, was no different. It was really no different. I had lost the job that I moved up there for, and I just found another one, and I decided to celebrate and go spend the last $82 that I had by skiing and drinking. And actually, to tell you the truth, that day I was not going to drink. I was not going to drink. I was going to ski. Just going to ski. Maybe have a nice little, you know, sandwich, maybe a little milk. I don't know. don't know why people drink milk. I could, driving to work as I'm sipping my peppermint schnapps, I literally would see people drink water, and I'm like, that can't be water. Who? Wait, honestly, my mind goes, why would you drink water? That does nothing for you. That's where my mind went. It's like, they can't be drinking water. You know, they can't be. Because it just doesn't make any sense. It just doesn't make sense. So I'd be drinking, I'd be toasting the people on the freeway. And I was thinking, we've got them fooled, right? But don't ever pick up the cup, the glass. You have to wash them off pretty regularly if you put schnapps in them because it's kind of sticky. And it does kind of dribble down, you know, a little. Not saying that I drool, but... So the glass starts to get a little sticky, so you have to wash them pretty regularly, just to let you know. You need to know. This is me, right? This is me. I'm utterly miserable. I'm drinking from morning to night. I can't get drunk in the sense of it's not making me feel any better. I'm in Seattle. Last day, I'm skiing, and I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to drink. And then I'm like, well, you know, I've heard some people say that one or two kind of loosens your legs up a little. Probably can ski a little better, right? So noon, I go in and I have a couple of drinks and I actually head back out and sleep like an hour. And I'm like, well, it's kind of cold now. This probably isn't doing anybody any good. And, you know, I'm going back home. I'm going back to the bar, right? Going back to where I'm comfortable. And so I sit in that bar and I drink literally. I drink until I don't have any money left, right? Literally not a dime left. But I got news that day that I had another job coming, and so, of course, I'm, you know, it doesn't really matter that I have no money. So what I do is I'm like, well, I'm out of money, and it's still like 9 o'clock at night, and I got to get all the way home, right? People are like, you should really stay in a hotel, and I'm thinking, you know, and I'm lying to them, oh, sure, I will. I'll stay one downtown. I'm like, I don't have the money, you know, and I can't admit that to anybody. So long story short, there's a bottle of Southern Comfort, and, you know, thank God it wasn't cream de menthe or something like that, but it was Southern Comfort, and it was at the end of the bar, and the bartender was looking that way, and I walked around the corner, and I just kind of, like, here's the bar, and I kind of just, I lay on the ground, I drop to the ground, in the middle of a bar, I drop to the ground, reach around, grab the bottle, take it, you know, get away with it. Thank God I got away with it, because I apparently needed one last bottle, right? Go into the bathroom, shove it into my ski pants, say thank you guys very much, walk out, and I'm drinking Southern Comfort on the way home and driving like a maniac. Go 90 miles an hour, spin out, right? Car comes to, it's like, right? So my solution is not drive slower or don't drink and drive. Mine's like, whew, thank God I lived through that. Now let's get home. And so, and honestly, I could tell you much worse stories about my drinking than that. I mean, you know, stealing one little bottle of booze, drinking all my money away, you know, driving 90 miles an hour in a spin out. That's you know, that's a regular day at the office. So I don't know what happened except for March 7th, 1995 when I woke up. And I'll tell you this, I was away from every enabler I had. I was away from my family. I was away from everybody. I didn't have a job. I didn't have any friends. The only people I knew were people who worked in a bar in downtown Seattle. And I woke up. And I remember going, oh, God, I'm in my bed, thank you. Right? Maybe I didn't say God, but I was just like, oh, I'm in my bed. Like, I'm not in jail. I'm not someplace else. I'm in my bed. And then I'm thinking, hopefully my car's okay. So I peek outside, and then as soon as I see my car, I go, there might be some Southern Comfort left. And at that moment, we all become religious. Thank you, Jesus, right? This is going to be a better morning than I thought. So, I mean, I'm these are all good things. I have not been arrested. It doesn't look like I wrecked my car. And there's booze left, right? I mean, that's an A-plus morning for me as an alcoholic. And you know what? The thoughts, and I didn't even get into it, the thought that struck me was that once again I had risked everything for a drink. My freedom, my family's peace of mind, other people's security, safety, everything, everything. And honestly, the thing that came to me is I have two nieces. Julia and Jennifer. And you know, I was a raging drunk and a maniac and all that, but I will tell you this, that the day my niece Julia was born, I was about 13 years old, and my sister, is also affected by alcoholism. I'm not saying she's an alcoholic, and I'm really not skirting the issue. I'm saying she grew up in an alcoholic family, right? And so she would do things like drop off my niece Julia with me and say, I'll be back in a couple hours and come back in a couple of days. So I learned to be, I raised my niece, sometimes days at a time. And my mom would say, you said you'd watch her, you watch her. And so I'd get up in the middle of the night and take care of her, take her through teething, rock her to sleep. When I got old enough to drive, she couldn't sleep, so I'd put her and her sister by this time, Jennifer, in the car and drive till they fell asleep and bring them back and put them to bed. And so I'll tell you this, and even in all that insanity, there were two things that tethered me to this earth, and those were my nieces. And they never saw me drunk because I wouldn't show up if I was drunk. And so when I woke up that morning and realized that I might have added more pain and suffering to those two little girls, and that I'd done this once again, the phrase of being sick and tired of being sick and tired made sense for the first time in my life. And I was heading out to get the booze. And just moment of clarity, if you will, right? I think that's what a lot of people call it. And I got down and I said, God, please help me not drink. And I didn't hear God's voice or anything like that, but the next thought that came to mind was, call AA. And I picked up the phone and I called AA. And my willingness immediately waned, right? It got lessened. Because I call and there's a lady at AA, and I'm like, well, I'm looking for an AA meeting, and this is where I live, and is there some kind of closing at this particular time frame that kind of suits into my busy schedule? And I'm sure I'm just a butthead on the phone, right? Because, well, I'm sure I'm like other new people who aren't sure, right? And I know having some time in sobriety that sometimes that's really painful to hear. And sometimes my temper, I'm not the most spiritual person when that happens because I'm hearing somebody say they want to die. Or more importantly, that they don't want to live. And this lady got a little curt with me and she said, if you're serious, you'll be at the noon meeting at the Allen Oak Club. Have a good day. Click. I'm Robert Hudock. I'm a sweet, warm, and wonderful person, as far as she knows. I know better. But I was just like, and you know what? That's exactly what I needed. It's like, if you're serious, you'll find a way to get to that meeting. If you're serious, and if not, good luck. Have a nice day. So I got, I took a shower and I put on a suit. Honestly, I tried to be as nice and polite and hardworking as possible when I got to AA because I was afraid you weren't going to let me stay. And I will say I came into these rooms somewhat humble and somewhat teachable, and not because I'm a good person or anything like that. I'm saying that because alcohol beat me there. I've heard people say that a higher power drives us out and alcohol drives us back in, and that has been my experience. And until I'm willing to make peace with my past and do the steps, I will not have peace, and I will probably drink again. So I made it to that noon meeting, and you know what? Everything I ever needed was in that meeting and at that place. The Allen Oak Club gave me my first job in sobriety. I jokingly say, well, it's not a joke, 2 weeks before I got sober, I was a vice president. 2 weeks after, I was flipping burgers and pouring your coffee at the Allen Oak Club. They were paying me $7 an hour, and I cried when they told me that I was worth that amount of money. And I was so incredibly grateful that there wasn't going to be booze there. And they gave me everything I needed. They gave me everything I needed. If you had asked me what I needed, I would have told you I needed a lot more than what I got. But I've never, ever, ever seen love and fellowship like I experienced at the Bellevue Club, the Alano Club, in Bellevue, Washington, on March 7, 1995, and every day since then. And so, I learned a lot. I learned a lot of good things in that time. One thing that was really helpful is that I got to hear what people said to me, and I got to see how they acted towards somebody as counter help in the club. And I saw inconsistencies. And I made sure that I picked a sponsor that didn't show inconsistencies. Meaning that if they talked about being really nice and spiritual and then, like, treated me like crap when I was trying to pour them a cup of coffee or make them a burger or something like that, I was like, okay, this is a really good education. You know, my sponsor, and I've done it again, right? I've got like 12, 13 minutes to tell you about all the great stuff now. Oh. Let me just tell you this. Everything I'm about to tell you is not because I'm a good person. It's because I was in a lot of pain. And everything I have today is because of this program. Everything. And I have achieved amazing success, not in just like being able to meditate pain away, but as to go out into the world and be of maximum service to God with all my fellows, not just alcoholics. Mind you, AA, first on the list. Alcoholic calls me, I'm here to help. Right? But I'll tell you this just in case I don't get to it. You know what my favorite hobby is today? I live in downtown San Jose. Los Gatos is where my home group is, so that's why they say I'm Robert of Los Gatos. But I really live in downtown San Jose. And I've taken up hobbies of, like, I did a first Olympic distance triathlon, which is like swim a mile, bike 25, and run 6.2. So I like to swim and run. Don't like to bike. But I run. I run 3.5 miles from my house and 3.5 miles back, right? 7 miles. And in downtown San Jose, it's not the most affluent area. And my favorite hobby is smiling at people. I'm jogging, and these are people who are walking with their head down. And I just hope that they look up, and I just smile. And these are people who apparently aren't smiled at very often because they just light up. They just light up. And I know I'm the crazy, you know, Anglo guy running through the neighborhood that they see on a regular basis. But I have friends. George, the homeless guy, is a very good friend of mine. I stop in and see him every Sunday that I'm in town. And then all the other people that I see at the various bus stops and things. And they're my friends. Right? They're my friends. And it's my favorite thing that I do, one of my favorite things that I do, is that I run and smile at people I don't even know. Right? The gifts that have been given to me are not mine. They're not mine. I was given them because I think God finally thought that maybe, just maybe, if he gave me something, I would share it with someone else. Just maybe. And I try not to disappoint him. So I got an AA, and what happened is, you know, all that competitive drive to do something to be loved actually became an asset. I got involved in competitive AA. When I had 30 days, no offense, I did not want to talk to another person with 30 days. I had heard the statistics that most people don't make it. I hung around with people with years. Not that there's anything wrong with people who have 30 days, not at all. I hang around with them now, right? But at that time, you know, I'd heard people say like 2-6 don't make a well. Right? And that, you know, two people with 30 days don't often get 60. And if that's, and if your experience is different, I'm not saying I'm right. I'm just saying this is what I did. And what was pointed out to me, it was to hang out with people who had years, who had done the steps, who could help me when my ass fell off. And so I will tell you, everybody I hung out with, everybody that I spent any considerable time with had years, which was like amazing to me. Now, there were sometimes other people with my amount of time because people with years hang around new people, but I was not calling people with 30 days to solve my problems, or 60 days or 90 days. Right? I was not. If your experience is different, that's great. I'm just telling about mine. But what happened is and these people would go, what's that beyond? 1, 2, 3, you should be able to do that like this. Boom, boom, boom. Right? You should be on 4. What do you mean you're working on 4? I don't see you working on 4. I see you talking about 4. Or if you're going to be technical about it, I'm balking on 4. I didn't balk long, though. I didn't balk long because I was in pain. And so I did my 4th step. And I'll tell you, you know, if you're new and you haven't done a 4th step, the only people I've heard complain about them are people who haven't done them. That's the first thing. And the second thing, it's only one of the steps. And the third thing is, it took me a whole weekend to do. That was it. Locked myself in a house for a weekend, worked 8 hours on Saturday, 8 hours on Sunday, followed the format, told my sponsor I was doing it, called him when I had questions, and was able to write out my whole 4th step in 2 days. It didn't take weeks, it didn't take months, it didn't take years. It took 2 days of fairly diligent work. And access to my sponsor so that if I had questions, I wouldn't get stopped. And when he wasn't around, I just kept going. I just kept going. And I saw him Sunday. I had maybe 90 days. I knew where he was. He was at the Sunday 2 o'clock meeting at the Allen O Club. I walked in. I said, I'm done. He said, only time I've ever seen my sponsor leave a meeting. He said, let's go. I was like, right now, we're in the middle of a meeting. He goes, let's go. Cool. And we go, and I'll tell you that, remember that life that I led where I was lying to everybody and everybody knew a different part of me? I told them everything. And if you think that the fourth step is just resentment, fear, and sexual inventory, read in the next chapter and it says that we do not know enough about humility unless we told somebody else our entire, all our life story. Please look it up. Is it all our life story? Whole story. Everything. Those things that I thought I would take to my grave, those things that happened to me as a little boy that scared me very much and confused me very much, that I swore I would never tell anybody. And now I get to share them with other men that experienced them too. And I get to say, you're not so weird. And I understand how you felt. And for the very first time in my life, I felt like God liked me. And it was in a beautiful park in Bellevue, Washington, and I looked at a tree and my sponsor said, God doesn't make crap. And he made you. The love that man showed me, and I mean love in action, not in his feelings, in his action. He hugged me after I told him all those things about myself and all the things I'd done. And he didn't run away. And that had a profound effect on me. And I'll tell you this one other thing about the third step is that when my sponsor told me I had to do a third step, he didn't say suggest it, he goes, you have to. However you want to view that, I don't care. But he said, you got to find a way. And so I'll tell you what I did. I prayed to my brother Jimmy. My brother Jimmy was dead. He was bigger than me, stronger than me, older than me. And I said, Jimmy, if there is a God, lie to him to get him on my side. That was my prayer. That was it. Right? Step two, when I defined it, I said, Jimmy's my higher power. He knows when I'm BSing. He wants me to be an adult and stand on my own 2 feet. And he'll help me any way I can, but he wants me to learn how to take care of myself. Right? That's the abridged version of what my higher power was to begin with. That's why I'm like, a higher power as you understand it. Right? And that's why I think it's so brilliant that it says that. So incredibly brilliant. So that's what I did. I prayed to my brother Jimmy, and I got on my knees, and I said my third step prayer, and I said, okay, Jimmy, do whatever you got to do to get God on my side. Right? Do whatever you got to do. And I believed that he would. I had felt love for my brother, and I believed he would. Right? And then I went on with the steps. I did 6, and I did 7, I did 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12, and I will tell you this, that my understanding of them did not even come close until I took other men through them. The third step didn't really make sense to me until I had 4 sponsees go through it in a 2-week period, and I had to explain it to someone else. So I had to learn it well enough to not just do it, but to explain it. Right? So that's why sponsorship is so important, because if I stop growing in my spiritual life, then I will die. I will. And the way that I grow spiritually is to continue to do the things I've done, as well as help somebody else do them. Right? It's an amazing principle of education that if you teach somebody else to do it, if I teach somebody else to do it, I learn it better. And that's a principle that's in human performance and education, because I've studied that since getting sober. I'll tell you a couple other things. I have no time or real compunction to try to tell you about all the amazing things that happen to me in my business world, but I've written books for Fortune 50 companies. I am CEO of the company that I've always wanted to be the CEO of, and it's very small but growing. I have partners in it now. I don't do it alone. And I'll tell you that the thing that I realized the most recently, 9 years and some change here, is that if I'm to be happy, I have to work the program harder today than I ever did. The thing that I realized is I called my sponsor and I'm like, Vic, right? I go, I'm doing a fears list like once a week right now, right? And I go, what a loser I am. Man, look at this. I'm just dripping with fear, right? And I'm in the middle of like all these things going on in my life with business and relationships and all these types of things. And I'm like, I'm having to do a fears list every week. And he goes, how amazing is that? And I was like, sponsors, we humor them, right? They don't fully get it, but we kind of talk to them, so we kind of sort it out ourselves. And I don't believe that at all. I love my sponsor. But the thing is that I do a fears list sometimes once a week, and I have to make amends. And every morning I read, I typed it out. I read the 10th and 11th steps just to make sure I didn't forget anything, you know. And it just printed out. It's on two pages, pretty easy. Tells me what to do if I run into any problems throughout the day. It has four things to do, right? You know, and I don't have them memorized. That's why I have it, you know, something like, you know, stop doing it, talk to somebody else, and I think the last thing is help someone else. get out of me. And but this is what I found, is that I have to work the pro. Well, the cool thing is my life has gotten bigger, and so there's more things that have my attention. So the program has worked in all these amazing aspects. I'm not some monk or guru sitting on a hill that, you know, doesn't like girls and, you know, and just gives all his money to charity and just kind of aimlessly walks around and smiles at people and hugs them. I'm a human, right? I'm an alcoholic doing the best I can. But I'll say this, that if you ever see me out there and you see me be unkind to anybody, please come up and give me a hug because I'm having a bad day. That is not my goal. That is not my goal. It means I'm having a bad day. And I say that I'm like a C-plus alcoholic. I've not done this perfectly. I've made every mistake in sobriety that I probably made out drinking. But now I have a way to correct those. And that's not a cop-out. I'm not saying that I still live that way, because I believe that stopping drinking is just one part for me. Every morning, I'll tell you how I start every morning. God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, the victory over them may bear witness to those I help with thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Then I go on to say, God, I pray your will and my will are the same. God. I guess God called while I was here. I've been waiting for that. That's going to answer a lot of things. My God is. God, I pray that your will is the desire of my heart. And God, I pray that I'm a maximum effectiveness to you today. And the only reason I have that memorized is because I've done it so many days in a row. And then I go into my living room where I have my daily meditation book. And I say the 10-step prayer that I read. And I do my morning meditation. And I sit quietly for 10 minutes. And then I go do the best job I can do. So, and that's not always very good, but it's the best job I can do. A couple of things is that I really do believe that to be sober and to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous is grace and God's grace, but also I believe it's a privilege. It's not a right. It's a privilege to be in this room, and it's definitely a privilege to have an intimate morning with you guys on a Saturday morning, because what this does is, this means every time I walk into a meeting and you guys are there, you know me, right? And I'm not alone anymore. So what I like to say in closing is that AA is a privilege and not a right, and I'm very, very privileged to be a member, a fellow member in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm privileged to be with you here today. Thank you very much. Yeah.